This is Geology Bites with Oliver Strimple. The fossil record of complex life goes back far beyond the Cambrian explosion to as far back as 1600 million years ago in the late Paleoproterozoic with the first appearance of eukaryotes. The conventional view is that these early eukaryotes did not undergo significant ecological and taxonomic expansion until hundreds of millions of years later, starting around 800 million years ago. The reasons for this expansion aren't clear, but one idea is that it reflects the appearance of microscopic predators that drove both diversification and evolutionary innovation around this time. A key aspect of this evidence is the discovery of signs of predation in tiny microfossils. Susanna Porter was the first to discover this very early predation. She is a professor in the Department of Earth Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Susanna Porter, welcome to Geology Bites.
Thank you, Oliver. I'm delighted to be here.
In a previous podcast with Rachel Wood, we talked about the fossil record going back as far as the soft-bodied creatures that inhabited the Ediacaran in the late Neoproterozoic about 600 million years ago, just before the start of the Cambrian. But you are looking at much earlier and much more primitive fossils. What sort of time period are we talking about, and what sort of fossils are these?
Yeah, 600 million years is actually quite young from my point of view. I work on fossils that are as old as 1600 million years or older, so the billion years or so before animals first appear on this planet. And the fossils that I focus on are the remains of eukaryotes. So that's one of the major branches in the tree of life, and it's the one that includes us, animals, as well as plants and fungi, and then a variety of protozoa and algae, collectively known as protists, microbial eukaryotes. And these fossils are almost entirely soft-bodied. They do not leave mineralized skeletons throughout this interval.
So we know that bacteria had existed for a long time, as recorded, for example, by sedimentary features formed by microbial mats, which are known as stromatolites, that go back as far as about 3.5 billion years ago. But here we're talking about eukaryotes. Forgive this really basic question, but how do we know these microfossils were eukaryotes and not bacteria, or indeed archaea, which also go back as far as the bacteria?
That's actually a really good question, because it's not always easy to distinguish bacterial fossils from eukaryotic fossils. And partly this is because some of the diagnostic traits of eukaryotes, like a nucleus or the presence of mitochondria, those organelles, are not preservable by and large. And so we're left with just looking at some aspects of their body shape. And this can include ornamentation, spines, branching structures that come off the vesicle, the cell that is preserved. We know that these structures can be made by modern eukaryotes. We have examples of that. And they're unknown in modern bacteria or archaea. And so we feel pretty comfortable assigning them to the eukaryotic clade. But there are a number of fossils that we find that we can't say. They could be bacteria and they could be eukaryotes.
So you just said that these fossils don't have skeletons. And in fact, this is hundreds of millions of years before biomineralization was, if you like, invented and hard skeletons appeared on the scene. So what kind of material did these early creatures produce that was tough enough to preserve their shape for long enough to appear in the fossil record?
Yeah, so it's kind of similar to, say, what pollen is made of. You know, you think about trees, flowering plants, they produce these little structures that are highly resistant and that actually form a pretty rich fossil record. So I'm not saying that these fossils are pollen or have the exact same composition, but it's similar to that. They're organic walled and they're made of resistant compounds that can withstand a lot of microbial degradation, for example. And part of the reason is that a lot of the fossils that we find are resting cysts. They are supposed to be resistant structures so that the organism themselves can sort of hibernate and not get attacked by, say, bacterial degraders.
I mean, just to get a feel of it, assuming they were big enough to sort of feel, if you had one between your fingers, would they be like grains of sand or would they be more kind of squishy?
I think of them as being more kind of squishy, the way plant material feels.
So kind of halfway between a really rigid skeleton and a really soft jelly-like thing.
Yeah, and part of the way we can tell this is that when they are preserved in, say, mudstones or shales, these very fine-grained, you know, laminated rocks, we find them squished. We find them flattened. Whereas if we were talking about something that made a mineralized skeleton, that will often still retain its shape.
So have you gone into the field yourself to find these microfossils in such sedimentary rocks?
Yeah, and one of my favorite field areas is in the Grand Canyon, in the oldest fossiliferous sedimentary rocks known as the Chewar Group, which are exposed in the eastern Grand Canyon. And traveling to the Chewar Group is kind of like going to the moon. It's really hard to get there, and you have to plan river trips. You have to access the rocks from the water. It's a 2.5-hour hike from the water out to the rocks. But once you get there, it's fantastic. The exposure is beautiful. And these rocks are so fossiliferous that pretty much any sample that I grab will have these very tiny microfossils and a diversity of them preserved.
Are they relatively rare? Does it require some really pretty unusual preservation conditions?
First of all, the number of rocks this age is pretty low. Most of the land is covered in rocks that are 600 million years or younger. So finding these, in this case, 750 million-year-old rocks from the Grand Canyon, they're pretty sparsely distributed around the planet. And then you need the rocks to not have been cooked too much. So it's important that they didn't see temperatures that were too high, because that can destroy the fossils. It's also, you need a certain type of rock, a type of lithology. So you'll typically find fossils like these in very fine-grained rocks like mudstones or clays or shales. Sandstones, for example, don't bother looking in. And then there's work being done right now trying to figure out if you're faced with, say, a whole section of shales, which are the ones you want to target. And we are finding sort of counterintuitively that the shales that are the least organic rich, so it's the shales that are sort of green in color or gray in color, have the best fossils. The ones that are really organic rich, chock full of organic matter, we typically won't find fossils at all. You'll find other organic crud in there, but not the fossils.
Do you know why that is?
We think that if there's a lot of organic matter in these sediments, then it sort of feeds the bacteria, and the bacteria can then easily degrade any would-be fossils that might fall into the mix. Whereas if it's very organic poor, it's sort of like a food desert. And so the fossils don't necessarily encounter bacteria that would eat them up. That's just one hypothesis. We're still trying to figure out what's going on.
So what happens next? You identify these rocks, you grab a few kilograms or however much of this rock in the field, and you take it back to your lab. What do you have in your lab? How do you analyze these fossils?
Yeah, so this is this funny thing. It's very different than, say, studying trilobites or dinosaurs, where you know you have the fossil out in the field when you've collected it. We collect these rocks, and because these fossils are so tiny, I mean, you literally cannot see them with your eyes. They're smaller than a speck of dust. I don't necessarily know if I've gotten anything. But we take them back to the lab, and we can process them in a couple different ways. For the mudstones, one common approach is to put them in 50% hydrofluoric acid, which is quite a dangerous acid. If you get a 10 milliliters spilled on you, you can potentially die. So you have to be very, very careful. But that hydrofluoric acid dissolves away all the minerals and it leaves behind the organic matter. And then we can sift through that to find the fossils. And then another, you know, much less dangerous approach is to actually section, to cut very thin sections of the mudstones and mount them on a glass slide, a microscope slide, and then you can shine a light through it and look under the microscope and basically look at an ancient, you know, seafloor bedding plane and look for evidence of fossils there.
So you can magnify enough using conventional light microscope, or do you need to use an electron microscope?
It's a good question. So you can certainly magnify enough to see the fossils, and you can often make out the ornamentation of the fossils, the spines, maybe designs on the walls. And that is often enough to do taxonomy, to figure out what species you have. But I became rather frustrated actually using the light microscope because it has a maximum resolution of 1 micron. And there are a lot of features that are tinier than a micron or about a micron in size. I was just dying to know what these walls really look like up close. And so we would put some of these, we call them macerates, the results of the acid dissolution, we'd strew them on slides or scanning electron microscope stubs and look at them under the scanning electron microscope. And then you can look at submicrometer features. And I should say micrometer is 1/1000th of a millimeter. So we're looking at very, very tiny features that we would not be able to see at all under a light microscope.
Which brings me to the topic that we're talking about today, which is predation. What exactly do you actually mean by the term predation when it comes to such microscopic life forms?
So a predator, by that I mean something that is going around killing other organisms. When I use the word predator, I'm distinguishing it from a grazer. A grazer is an organism that is eating the primary producer, sort of the bottom of the food chain. Whereas a predator is something that is eating, say the grazers, is eating other organisms that are eating organisms, so higher up in the food chain. And with respect to the fossils that I've been studying, I think what is significant here is that the evidence of predation, it's predation on eukaryotes, on these protists. And before this time, we knew certainly that eukaryotes were around and that they were eating bacteria. Bacteria were getting grazed on. But we didn't know whether those eukaryotes themselves were getting eaten by anybody. And so this is the first evidence that we actually have sort of another tier in the food chain.
And what actually is the evidence for predation?
So there's several different lines of evidence. Initially, for my PhD work, I focused on some fossils from the Grand Canyon that are called vase-shaped microfossils. And they do look just like little flower vases with sort of an opening in one end where you put in the flowers, right? And it turns out that these are shells or tests made by amoebae. So kind of similar to the way snails make their own shells, there are amoebae today that make their own shells, often quite beautifully decorated. And these vase-shaped microfossils looked just like these testate amoebae. And the modern testate amoebae are predators. So they'll eat bacteria, but they'll also eat other protists. And in fact, they'll capture other little animals. They live today on films, on moss, in peat bogs and forest litter. So they're pretty important predators in these microbial ecosystems. So that was sort of indirect evidence that we had already that we must have had predators around. But I mentioned the scanning electron microscope work. So I started diving into that to do a taxonomic description of the variety of organic walled microfossils that I found in the CHUAR group. And it's one of these serendipitous things where I started to notice, I was, you know, zooming up really close, trying to see what the ornamentation was like on these fossils. And I started noticing that a number of them had perfectly circular holes, about a tenth of a micron to a half of a micron in size. And the holes seemed to sort of go in maybe at different angles or be slightly beveled. It was clear that they weren't part of the ornamentation of the fossil itself. They were often randomly distributed on a single fossil. They were found in some specimens of a species, but not all. They were found in a variety of different species. And it was very different than the kind of holes that, say, minerals growing in the sediment might make on a protofossil. And for me, it was sort of a linchpin was that because I had studied vase-shaped microfossils and testate amoebae during graduate school, I was familiar with some modern amoebae and their behaviors. And I knew about a group of amoebae known as vampire amoebae, the vampirellids, they're called. And they attack their prey. They attack green algae. And they also live in the soil and attack fungal spores. Anyway, they make perfectly circular holes that just look exactly like the ones that I was seeing in my microfossils. I think that, to my mind, was pretty strong evidence for predator attack. And it's not attack like swallowing their prey, but they will pierce a hole in the wall of their prey and then stick in their pseudopods, finger-like extensions of the cell, and pull out some of the cytoplasm, and then phagocytose that, swallow it like a Pac-Man.
But how does it make the hole? I mean, it doesn't have a little microscopic drill, does it?
No. And pierce maybe is the wrong word in the sense of it's not like they're taking a needle and poking through. What we guess is that it's secreting some kind of enzyme that is macerating, that is dissolving the wall. And it's interesting looking at modern vampire amoebae, which are the best studied. There's different taxa of vampire amoebae, different species, and they make holes of different sizes, and it tends to be species specific. So some species make maybe 0.1 micron circular holes. Others make much larger holes, a micron or so in size, and they use a different process. They actually will digest away a ring. And then in the way that you might remove a manhole cover, they remove that circle that they have formed in the prey's wall and actually swallow that and then put their pseudopods inside and grab chunks of the cytoplasm.
That's an incredible image to have an ancient microorganism drilling a ring, pulling out a manhole or eating the manhole, then sticking an arm, if you like, or a pseudopod inside and grabbing.
Yeah.
If that doesn't count as predation, nothing does.
Yeah, I had so much fun digging into this literature because it gets even worse than that from the point of view of the prey. After they've taken out the guts of the cell of the prey, some of them will then go inside themselves in this empty husk and then reproduce, you know, make babies and then make further holes to escape out of the prey. So I found evidence of these tiny holes. And these tiny holes had been reported by other paleontologists. I wasn't the first to discover the holes, but other people had just suggested, oh, maybe it's just microbial degradation. But in addition, I mentioned those vase-shaped microfossils, which themselves were predators back then. But some of them also have these really unusual holes that are half-moon-shaped. They're not circles. They're half of a circle, semicircle. And they're in kind of the main body of the test, and they seem to be aligned with the axis of the test. And I've always been puzzled about these, but my best guess is that they are holes made by some other predator. They're much larger. They're about 30 micrometers. So a different predator. And one that had maybe a stereotype behavior holding the test in a certain position such that the half moon was always aligned in a certain way. That suggests we have several different predators in these ancient ecosystems.
The predators themselves were prey for other predators.
Yeah.
I should probably have said this before, but when you say test, that's really the skeleton we're referring to that's fossilized, right?
Yeah, that's the shell. When I talked about snails make their own shells and some amoebae make their own shells.
So I said in my introduction that predation may have been instrumental in early diversification of eukaryotes and evolutionary innovation. What sort of innovations do we see around this time?
One big one we see is actually mineralized skeletons. This is a really fascinating discovery that was first made in the 80s. They are called scale-like microfossils, and they're about 10 to 20 micrometers in size, and they look like little shield that have a variety of decoration. Some of them have spines coming off of them. Some of them have little hexagonal holes throughout. And the big surprise with them is it was always assumed they were siliceous in composition. But they were restudied by Phoebe Cohen and Nick Butterfield and others in the 2000s. And they found, much to everybody's surprise, that they were phosphatic, which is bizarre because no protists make phosphatic mineralized skeletons. But these appear in rocks about the same age as these vase-shaped microfossils and the other predation holes. And if you look at them, they're preserved in clusters of similar type scales, and there's dozens of species. And we know that modern protists, a number of different protists throughout the tree of eukaryotes, make scales. Coccolithophorids are a great example. But one reasonable speculation is that at least with these scales 800 million years ago, that they may have served as a defense against predation. And one thing you can point to is especially the scales that have these spines sticking out. If you can imagine, they armored this cell, they increased the size of the cell, It would have been difficult to, say, swallow this creature, right? And it would have been difficult to attack them the way vampire amoebae attack. So that's one innovation, which I think is reasonable to think reflects this advent of predators. Another is we start to see more multicellular organisms around this time, seaweeds. And again, one adaptation to the single cell to get preyed on is to become part of a larger creature. It's harder to attack if you're bigger. And there have been experiments where scientists have put single-celled predator in with a bunch of single-celled algae, and they do evolve to form multicellular structures.
We often think of early evolution of life as being critically affected by the environment and vice versa, which is why we talk of co-evolution. But what do we know about the physical and chemical environment at the time we're talking about here?
Well, this time period that we're talking about, oxygen levels were still quite low, but there was some oxygen in the atmosphere and in the oceans. We know that microbial mats with oxygen-producing bacteria, the cyanobacteria, were widespread. This could have been, and certainly was, a home for a lot of eukaryotes. Those vase-shaped microfossils I mentioned, we find them associated with some microbial mat layers. So I can imagine them moving around, eating those bacteria, eating other protists. One interesting thing about the environment during this time is that it seems that the chemistry of the oceans was different in terms of phosphorus levels. It was a lot higher. And that's one reason why maybe those first skeletons were made of phosphorus. There were many more areas of the ocean that were anoxic, that had dissolved iron in the oceans. Some parts of the ocean were not only anoxic, but sulfidic, sort of a hydrogen sulfide, which forms that stinky rotten egg smell. So it was a very different world. And depending on the habitats of eukaryotes, if they really were restricted to oxygen-rich oases, they might have been more restricted in space. Certainly no question more than they are today.
So do you think there is evidence for an environmental trigger that started this predation defense arms race and led to the diversification and innovation that we've just been discussing?
There is some evidence that oxygen levels may have risen around this time. And you could potentially spin a story tying rising oxygen levels to the advent of predation. We know in modern environments, for example, where oxygen levels are really low, among the microbes, predation pressure is not that great. Basically, you have the primary producers and you have the grazers. And it's in the environments with more oxygen that can support predation. So that's one idea, that maybe if you get oxygen levels high enough, you can get microbial ecosystems that can support those higher levels in the food web. But I still feel like it's a little bit of an open question.
One of the things you mentioned when you were talking earlier is that what we see is subject to at least two enormous biases, one being whether something is preserved or not in the fossil record, in other words, how well it's preserved. And the other is that so many of the species around at that time are extinct.
And there's additional biases, and that is, you know, we're talking about the record of predation. I mean, these holes are difficult to see. It may go back a lot further. And in fact, one of my colleagues, Corentin Laurent, has documented what look like predation holes in billion-year-old fossils. But you're right. The vast majority of modern microbial eukaryotes would not get preserved. They just don't make any preservable structures. So we're seeing a very small slice. And the slice that we are seeing is often hard to make sense of because they represent clades that have gone extinct and that maybe have some characteristics of modern eukaryotic groups, but not all. And they also have some of their own characteristics that make them distinct. And so a lot of the time, I'd say for most of this early eukaryote fossil record, we don't know what we are dealing with other than eukaryotes. And even then, as I said earlier, we don't necessarily know in some cases whether a fossil is from a eukaryote.
Which in turn would go to your point that it's still an open question if these creatures needed, let's say, extra oxygen in order to evolve the way they did. I mean, maybe they had characteristics that enabled them to do just fine without oxygen.
Yeah, this is kind of a fight I've been picking lately, actually, is this assumption that is out there that if we go back in time, 1 billion years ago, 1,500 million years ago, all those eukaryotes were aerobic, that they required oxygen. And there's a couple problems with that assumption. One is that today, if we look at these different environments, anoxic environments, there are protists that are adapted to anaerobic lifestyles, that they can't actually survive in the presence of oxygen. So we know that modern eukaryotes, a lot of them will live in anoxic environments, even these anoxic sulfitic environments with the help of bacterial symbionts. And then the other thing is it's entirely possible that the very first eukaryote, and I'm talking about that first lineage that branched off, the closest living relatives today to eukaryotes, so the archaea, it may have been anaerobic itself. And at some point in the evolution toward what we call, what we think of the modern eukaryote, so the last common ancestor of all living eukaryotes, that almost certainly had need oxygen at some point in its life. Maybe it could also deal with anoxic environments. But we can say, well, that probably used oxygen based on the characteristics that we think it had. But at some point between that guy and that very early first eukaryote, there could have been a transition to requiring oxic environments. We don't know when that transition occurred. And so that means that some of these early eukaryotes that we see in rocks that are 1.5 billion years old, they might have been adapted to anoxic environments. We can't assume that they required oxygen. Then, you know, if they persisted, which we see a lot of taxa, a lot of species persisting for hundreds of millions of years through the Proterozoic, they're persisting into, say, the rocks that I study in the Grand Canyon. Some of those taxa might have been adapted to anoxic environments. They might have been relics of these very early eukaryotes. And what would be a really interesting thing, do we only see those perforations, those drill holes in fossils that we think were living in oxygenated environments? So that would be an interesting test of that hypothesis that oxygen is an important cause in the rise of predation.
That's interesting. So both are evidence for a sudden change in environment and indeed the complementary lack of clarity as to whether there was even a burst of evolutionary activity that happened suddenly enough to reflect some such trigger. Both of those seem to be open questions. And I wonder whether you would feel the same way about the Cambrian explosion. I mean, was that a really distinct explosive, so to speak, event that resulted from something in the environment? Or is that, again, a selection effect or something that doesn't really reflect what happened at the time?
You know, I have more confidence in the Cambrian explosion representing something really important. Something I've worked on is the earliest biomineralizing animals. And I think there it's clear that there's really something important going on. Skeletons obviously do have a good fossil record, right? And so when they show up in the fossil record, you can be pretty confident that that's approximately close to the time that those skeletons evolved. And what we see looking at the early Cambrian is mineralized skeletons evolving over and over again independently across the tree of animals. I don't see how you explain that as a bias or, you know, preservational bias. That's real. That's telling us that something important happened at that time. And I think that it's predation. I think that we're seeing a repeat of the same events, ecological events that happened several hundred million years before in microbial ecosystems. We're seeing them in animals for the first time around the earliest Cambrian, latest Ediacaran. I mentioned the Ediacarabiota. They're soft-bodied. They are not making mineralized skeletons. And there's no evidence that they're being preyed on, that there's any other large creature taking bites out of them. And then around the same time that we see these mineralized skeletons, we start seeing evidence of predation, and we see evidence of creatures that would be the predators. And sure enough, the skeletons themselves sure look like they evolved to function in defense. They are carapaces, sort of shields, which would cover the soft parts, or they're spines. One of my favorite creatures kind of looks like a barrel cactus. It's covered in spines. It seems like those really are functioning in defense. And we even see this if we look at details, some of these mineralized skeletons, some of them are well enough preserved that we can see the crystallites and how they're arranged, the microstructure of the skeletons. And these, again, seem to be adapted to defense against crushing. So everything in my mind is pointing toward that part of the Cambrian explosion and the evolution of skeletons is the appearance of carnivores.
Do you have any theories as to why it took so long after that initial predation that was sort of invented, if you like, in these microfossils, for it to appear again with these larger, more complex creatures in the Cambrian, and therefore maybe co-evolved with these mineralized outer shells or skeletons? Or just even asking the question, like, why did it take so long? Are we presupposing some kind of timescale that we have no right to presuppose?
I think that's fascinating, that it's the same result, that it's an organism evolving to eat its relatives, basically. In protists, in animals, have to do it in such different ways because of their sizes. Why did it take so long? There's two schools of thought. There are those who like the idea that these biological innovations are just waiting to happen, but there's some break that's put on them that's such that they can't. And so that's this idea that maybe oxygen levels, that once you have release of this break, you know, oxygen levels were too low. Once oxygen levels rise, then you have the ability to evolve creatures that are more active. They have faster metabolisms. They need oxygen to be able to be predators. And then I guess the other school of thought is that a rise in oxygen, or we know a release of whatever environmental variable, doesn't necessarily mean that these innovations are inevitable and that there's contingent events that have to occur. I think when you see convergent evolution, similar characteristics evolving over and over again, that makes me lean toward the first school of thought, that these characters will evolve given the chance. And I think with predation, that's one of those that eventually, given time, organisms will figure out how to eat each other.
What are you working on at the moment?
So one thing I'm interested in is looking at patterns in the acquisition of mineralized skeletons. I did work earlier looking at carbonate skeletons in animals and documenting how many different times these skeletons evolved and when did they evolve, and when they did, what kind of mineralogy was selected for, aragonite or calcite. And there's a really interesting pattern there where the appearance of the carbonate skeleton in animals corresponded to what seawater chemistry favored at the time. And this includes other minerals, mineralized skeletons like phosphatic and siliceous. But in the carbonate skeletons, they're all aragonite. And then in the later part of the early Cambrian and into the Ordovician, everybody who evolved a mineralized carbonate skeleton chose calcite. And then it switches back again to aragonite. And then it switches back again to calcite. So there's interesting patterns in skeletal mineralogy through time. And I wanted to expand that work to look across all eukaryotes. And it's a pretty ambitious undertaking because we're talking about like more than 80 acquisitions of mineralized skeletons. But so far, what I'm finding is a really interesting pattern that whereas the animals, there's this big burst. Two-thirds of animals that evolved mineralized skeletons did so in the early Cambrian. With the protists, you don't see signs of the Cambrian explosion at all. Their skeletal acquisitions are kind of randomly distributed throughout the Phanerozoic, the last 550 million years. And that suggests to me, again, the fact that the acquisition of mineralized skeletons in animals in the early Cambrian really is an animal event. It reflects an ecological factor that affected only animals. If it were something like a change in ocean chemistry, you'd think that the protists might also record that somehow, and they don't.
Susanna Porter, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Oliver. Thank you so much.
For more about Geology Bites, as well as pictures and illustrations that support this podcast, you can go to geologybites.com.